You are listening to Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement, with your host, Randy Sutton. Hello and welcome to this week's episode of Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement on the America Out Loud Network. I'm your host, Randy Sutton. I want to thank you for taking the time to join us this week, where we talk about all things law enforcement. So let's take a walk into the briefing room, where I'm going to give you my view from the blue. Lots to talk about this week. Lots to talk about. Not that we ever seem to run out of topics when it comes down to the American law enforcement officer and the things that they are facing. A very interesting topic, and that is, let's go back a few years. Eric Garner. Eric Garner was the man who died while being arrested in New York City. This took place almost 5 years ago now. And I'll remind you of the incident. He was a very, very large man, huge, as a matter of fact. And he was selling Lucy's, what they're called. They're basically selling loose cigarettes in an area of New York City. And people had made constant complaints about him, you know, these business people in the area. So NYPD was dispatched. They confronted him, and they placed him under arrest. Unfortunately, Garner did not go along with the arrest. He resisted, and because of his size, one of the officers got behind him, grabbed him around the shoulder and the neck, and brought him down to the ground. During that time, Garner died. And the people went insane, claiming that the police officer choked him to death. So the feds looked at it and did not prosecute, did not say that the officer did anything wrong. The district attorney looked at the case and did not find any wrongdoing on the part of the police. But the NYPD itself has not made any ruling about the officer's conduct. And, of course, the media has played this up so that it makes it look like the police officer did a, quote, chokehold, unquote, and choked him to death. Now, here's what's interesting. The lawyers for the police officer, and this officer has been, his name is Officer Pantaleo. He's been set to go now before a disciplinary trial. And they have the Civilian Complaint Review Board charged him with excessive force violations. But the NYPD has been stalling on releasing the actual cause of death of Garner, because what has been put out in the media is that the police officer choked him to death. And the NYPD has resisted all efforts to make the autopsy public and give it to the attorneys. Well, now that this officer has been charged by the department with excessive force, now this is after all these years, they finally have given the autopsy results to the officer's attorneys. And guess what? He didn't do a chokehold, and it wasn't the officer that killed him. It was his Garner's medical conditions, because of his obesity and the diseases that he had, that when he exerted himself, that's what killed him. It wasn't, there was no choking, there was no damage to his neck or any of the bones in the neck, which would indicate strangling. So in essence, what killed Eric Garner was Eric Garner. The fact that he resisted arrest, he chose to resist, and because of his medical condition, He died. Meanwhile, this officer is being vilified. Now the department itself is charging him with excessive force. And these officers that were on this scene did everything they could to take Garner into custody without any force. They didn't pepper spray him. They didn't hit him with their baton. They simply used hands-on techniques to bring him to the ground to get him handcuffed. And because of that, because of his medical condition, he died. This is one of those unintended consequences of people who resist arrest. And they paid, by the way, the city of New York paid out millions of dollars to this guy's family. And this is what is happening throughout the country. These cities don't have the guts to stand up for their cops, and they don't have the guts to stand up for what is right. The fact of the matter is, Eric Garner caused his own death because he chose to resist. End of story. And we'll see now what happens in the disciplinary board hearing against Officer Pantaleone, who has been quite literally had his entire life disrupted simply because he was trying to do his job the best way that he could. While we are talking about the way cities and governments treat their cops, there is some lunacy going on in Boston that is beyond belief. It is so disturbing that it is one of those things that I'm shaking my head. Here's what happened. Here's what's going on. Boston just elected. Now this is for the district attorney's office for Boston. Okay, that is the Suffolk district attorney. Suffolk County encompasses Boston. We're talking a major, major city here, and the Rachel Rollins is the newly elected district attorney, and she got elected on a platform that is mind-boggling, and that platform is not about law and order, it's about disorder, and she has made the promise that she will not prosecute a whole series of offenses, and it's absolutely shocking that any politician, especially a district attorney, could get elected on the platform of not prosecuting crimes. It's mind-boggling. You know, one of the things that you would think that voters would really look at is how to stay safe. And if you don't prosecute crimes, how do you stay safe? Let me read you the list of crimes that this new district attorney, she takes office in January. She got elected on this platform, and she has announced that now she's elected. When she begins her term of office, she will not be prosecuting trespassing, shoplifting, larceny under $250, disorderly conduct, disturbing the peace, receiving stolen property, driving offenses, breaking and entering where the property is vacant or where it is for the purpose of sleeping or seeking refuge from the cold and there is no actual damage to the property. So, if somebody goes into your house and you live in Boston and they just decide that they're going to sleep in your house, they're not going to prosecute it. Yeah, okay. Wanton or malicious destruction of property. Threats. Minor in possession of alcohol. Drug possession. Drug possession with intent to distribute. Resisting arrest. Resisting arrest combined with only charges that all fall under the list of charges to decline to prosecute. So, in other words, a police officer arrest somebody for breaking and entering, and they resist and they wind up charging them with resisting arrest, they're not going to prosecute that because it's an offense that she is choosing not to prosecute. Think of the madness here. Think of the insanity. And also think of how it's going to affect the people who live in Boston. This is, in essence, telling every criminal and drug dealer that there are no consequences for your actions. This is lawlessness that is accepted and endorsed by the highest law enforcement official in Suffolk County, the district attorney. I can't even imagine how this is going to affect the crime rate of this city. And then let's talk about the effect that it's going to have on law enforcement. If you're a police officer in Boston, and you just had basically every normal arrest that you would make during your shift just removed from the prosecution list, what are you supposed to do? And this is the danger here. This is a activist who is now in charge of law enforcement in a major city. And she, for her own political reasons, is choosing not to comply with the laws of the state. Now, I personally cannot understand how, first of all, I can't understand how she got elected. Are the people of Boston so blind to the consequences of this that they would vote her into office? I find that mind-boggling. Now that this is a reality, now that she is actually going to be in charge of the district attorney's office, I think that the state attorney general or the governor need to remove her or force her to prosecute. If the statute is there, you don't have the right as an elected official to say, oh, I'm just not going to prosecute. And just accept that these laws, which are on the books for a damn good reason, can be ignored. So I find this so disturbing because we are seeing more and more, at quote, activist, unquote, district attorneys who are using their positions in a truly anti-law enforcement way. And the more that we see of this, the more we're going to see criminality going out of control. This is not only dangerous to the public, it's exceedingly dangerous to the police, because what it does is it now opens them up for all kinds of civil litigation and punishment when they try to do their jobs. This is something that I will be watching and reporting on as I get more information about it. But it is truly one of the most disturbing actions I have seen from a district attorney. Let's talk about some other stuff. While we're talking about the district attorneys, I'm shocked again. Another politically motivated prosecution of a law enforcement officer is now taking place in Los Angeles. Los Angeles County Sheriff's Deputy Luke Liu is now being held on $1.1 million bond for a voluntary manslaughter charge. Now, this guy is a 10-year veteran. He's a highly decorated officer. And he was confronting a suspect. The guy got into his car. The deputy ordered him out of the car. The suspect reached in the back seat The officer drew his weapon and ordered him once again to show his hands and get out of the car. Instead, he threw the car into drive and ran it into the deputy. Ran it into his legs, and as the deputy was trying to extricate himself, he shot the suspect. Well, what the hell is wrong with that? That's what you're supposed to do if somebody uses an automobile as a weapon against you. It is, an automobile is a weapon. You get hit by a 3,000-pound car, what do you think is going to happen? Every police officer has a right to defend himself from death or serious bodily injury. This officer took the actions that he should have taken. And now, this is like 2 years later, the district attorney decides he's going to arrest him for voluntary manslaughter. Put him under over $1 million bail and charge him with an offense that could lead to more than 20 years in prison. This is another one of the serious issues involving district attorneys who are deciding to use their positions of power against law enforcement, not to protect it, but to once again show how the war on cops is continuing. It's not just the suspects anymore. We are fighting within our own system of criminal justice. This needs to be addressed, and I'm not seeing anybody addressing it. Deputy Luke Liu is now facing the fight of his life. And that, my friends, is my view from the blue. For my active duty law enforcement officers, and probably some military as well, if you wear body armor, you want to arrest the odor. Yes, you want to arrest the odor because we know how nasty it can get. StinkyVest.com. That is where you get Arrest My Vest Spray. It's military police grade odor eliminating spray. This is amazing stuff. And you don't actually have to use it just for your vest, although it's made specifically for that. It is all natural, it has no harsh chemicals, but it's good for basically any odor eliminating at all. It's safe on your Kevlar, it is really amazing stuff, and you know how uncomfortable it can get, how hot those vests are. So check it out, stinkyvest.com, and it is the technology of odor absorbing molecules that makes this such an amazing product. Check it out, stinkyvest.com. I want to take a moment and tell you about the books that I have written and are available on Amazon.com. My first three books were all law enforcement related, and they were stories. My first was True Blue, Police Stories by Those Who Have Lived Them, followed by A Cop's Life, and then the third, True Blue to Protect and Serve. My latest book came out just in September. It's called The Power of Legacy, Personal Heroes of America's Most Inspiring People. And this was an amazing book for me to put together. They are the stories of people throughout this country, people who have done amazing things with their lives, about who their personal heroes were and how they inspired them. This is a book that I hope will touch the lives of people all over this country. If you get a chance, check it out, Amazon.com. It is The Power of Legacy, Personal Heroes of America's Most Inspiring People.
Let the silent voices be heard. It's the rallying call that started it all. AmericaOutloud.com. For a wide spectrum of programming from world and political news, societal and cultural stories, law enforcement, our military heroes, and much more. News blogs, informative podcasts, and entertaining videos. Welcome to the new era in communications, America Out Loud Talk Radio.
Think back to the last time you felt healthy and energized. The best times of our lives occur when we're at the peak of our health. Sleeping better, full of energy and focus. We know that fades with age, and you might be feeling the effects of aging as low energy and poor sleep. But it doesn't have to be that way. There haven't been any nutrition systems designed to rejuvenate our bodies as we get older, until now. Healthy Cell Pro is the only multi-nutrient system that impacts the building block of your body, the cell. Created by anti-aging expert and Nobel Prize nominee, Dr. Vincent Giampapa, award-winning Healthy Cell Pro cuts through the complexity of nutrition supplements by simply giving you the purest ingredients, filling dietary gaps to nourish your cells and enhance your quality of life for optimal performance. Visit HealthyCell.com and use code OUTLOUD for an exclusive discount or call 844-869-9958.
With me today in the interview room of Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement, is Bob Bemis. And Bob's story is one that I am very proud to present today. Bob is a 25-year veteran of the Pennsylvania State Police. He is also the author of a book that is about the challenges that he has faced in reference to being struck by a vehicle and critically injured. His story is called Forged in Scars and Stripes, A Trooper's Victory Over Critical Injury. Bob, thanks so much for appearing on Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement.
Well, thank you for having me, Randy. I really appreciate it.
You are doing important work, my friend. You are speaking about a topic that is very difficult to talk about and yet is so necessary. First of all, let's go back into your history. Let's talk about your police career. You started with the Pennsylvania State Police and retired from them.
Yeah, that's correct. I actually have over 30 years of law enforcement experience. My time in law enforcement actually began before the state police, working as a military policeman in the United States Marine Corps for 6 years on active duty.
Ah, so that's where you got your taste of it, came out, did 6 years in the Marines, and then joined the state police?
That's correct. Yeah, I came on with the state police in 1993, graduated from our academy in the town of Hershey, Chocolate Town, USA, and then received an assignment over to the western side of the state near Pittsburgh. Throughout my career, traveled all over in various assignments all over the state of Pennsylvania, working in assignments in patrol and in criminal investigation before I finally settled into a position as a trainer back in Hershey at our State Police Academy.
That's one of the most critical jobs in the agency as well, talking about training those who serve. So tell us about the injury that you received and how it happened.
Yeah, absolutely. On the morning of March 27th of 2015, I was actually in the town of Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania, northeastern part of the state. And I was preparing to teach a class to members of that local city police department on the dangers of people who have extremist anti-government beliefs. And that's a class that I had developed for the state police, and the demands for that training took me all over Pennsylvania and some of the surrounding states. So I was that morning, I was getting ready to teach that class, I went, gave the training, finished up the training in the early afternoon on that day, packed up my car and began traveling back to Hershey to start my weekend. It was a Friday morning, Friday during the day. And along the way, along an interstate highway there, Interstate 81, I observed a vehicle that was on the side of the road that was on fire. I stopped my unmarked police car, was wearing a suit, got out in my suit, got the fire extinguisher out of the trunk and was walking toward the vehicle that was on fire with the disabled vehicle's operator when the lights went out. Smoke from the fire was traveling out into the roadway. Vehicles that were approaching the scene were hitting their brakes and swerving to avoid making contact with one another. One of those vehicles, an SUV, traveled off the roadway. Struck a guide rail, continued along the berm, struck the back of my unmarked police car, and my unmarked police car then went forward and struck both myself and the disabled vehicle's operator. Stinks to get hit by a car, but it's worse when it's your own car.
Yeah, I can imagine that. Yeah, understood. So you were severely injured in this. Tell us about the extent of your injuries.
Absolutely. The injuries themselves, the most serious injury was to my L1 vertebra, which was completely crushed and contributing to what's known as an incomplete spinal injury, which involves, paralysis below the waist. To this day, my feet are still paralyzed. I had a badly broken left femur. My left lung had collapsed. Ligaments in my left shoulder were torn. My left hand was badly broken. There was a severe impact with the pavement by my head, which was so serious that it actually damaged the optic nerve in my left eye, resulting in permanent vision loss in my left eye. After the accident, a couple of the witnesses to the accident were actually police officers from the Amtrak Police Department, and both of those individuals immediately came to my aid. One of them remained by my side, providing some initial first aid, while the other and an arriving trooper from a local barracks, both of them emptied several fire extinguishers to keep the flames from reaching me. So those three people are responsible for me being able to talk to you today. So, again, following that, I was flown by helicopter to Geisinger Medical Center in Danville, Pennsylvania, where I was immediately rushed into a surgery that lasted 8 hours that stabilized my spine and, repaired my broken leg. A couple of days later, I went through another surgery that lasted 7 hours, I believe it was, which completed the repairs to my spine, repaired my hand, and did some other things. I spent a total of 55 days between two hospitals, and then months and months of recovery before I was able to even continue to go back to work in a limited capacity.
Well, let's talk. All right, let's talk about that. You spent just a long term in the hospitals, then rehab. You still are paralyzed in your feet. You lost your vision in your eye, and you wanted to go back to work?
Absolutely. The crazy thing was, before I was even really understanding the full gravity of how badly I'd been injured, when I woke up in the hospital 24 hours after the accident, I had a tube in my throat. I couldn't speak. I motioned for one of my coworkers who was there to give me a pad to write on, and one of the things that I told her was the next time that she came back to the hospital to bring her laptop computer because we had work to do. So I don't believe at that point that I fully understood the gravity of what I wanted to do, how badly I was injured. But then, obviously in the months after that, the whole goal and focus was that I was going to return to work. I was going to get back to full duty and continue to fight the fight.
That's more than admirable. You did, in fact, return to work, which I got to tell you shows an amazing drive and determination. When you went back to work, did you go back in the capacity as a trainer?
Yes. Of course I was in a limited capacity, because of the mobility issues, walking on forearm crutches and, to get around. But, I found that I could still clearly communicate, information to other people. And, I was not going to stop doing that just because I couldn't, I couldn't walk very fast. So I was able to, go back to my job as a trainer, stand in front of groups of people, continue to train on the topics that I had been regularly teaching before. I was able to drive without any specialized equipment in my car, so therefore I could travel as I had done before to teach at other locations as well. So it was really important for me to be able to get back and recapture some of the things that I was still able to do.
When you went back to work, what was the reaction from your coworkers and your staff?
Well, the reaction, the initial reaction, as it was all throughout the months of recovery before I returned to work, the initial response was one that is almost indescribable with regard to the show of support from my coworkers and friends. It is everything that we expect it to be in the aftermath of an incident like this. I broke the rehab hospital record for visitors. If you had a short haircut or looked even the slightest bit official when you came into the hospital, before you even got to the reception desk to inquire as to what room I was in, the receptionist would just point down the hall and say, "He's in room 1012." Before they had an opportunity to even ask. The 800 cards that decorated the walls and windows of my hospital room, there wasn't a spare inch of drywall available for another card. And I received an additional 400 cards sent to my home in the months after after I left the hospital. So the initial support was absolutely there by the members of the department. Every milestone was celebrated in grand fashion by the command staff and the leaders that were in place at the time. The first day that I went back to work, and in the initial first week after I went back to work, there was no such thing as productivity on my part, because every 5 minutes someone else was stopping into my office to extend their well wishes and to visit. So it was a tremendous example of what the term brotherhood really means.
And let's talk about that for a moment. How critical was that support from both your coworkers and your command staff? How important was that to your healing process?
Well, I think it was absolutely critical in order for me to understand that I wasn't alone, that the promise that is implied in the words, "I got your back, brother," were played out in reality for me. I was struggling with certainly the physical and emotional injuries that I had received, the impact that had not only on myself but on my family. It was a life-changing experience, and to have and need the support of your coworkers and your command staff to just go back to the job that you loved was absolutely critical.
Now you've spent 25 years as a police officer, not counting your time in the Marines. You're aware from being on the speaker circuit and interacting with other injured police officers that what took place with you and that support is not always the case with others. How have you interacted with other injured police officers when it comes down to hearing their stories?
Oh, it's heartbreaking, I guess, is the easiest way to describe what when you hear the stories of the struggles that our other survivors are going through, and every story is unique. I told you that the initial response by my agency and by my family and friends and coworkers and everything was a very positive one, but it didn't always stay that way. There were some things that occurred in my after my return to work that, were not as good as I would have liked them to be. I my value to the agency seemed to change a little after my return, and that's exactly what I'm finding from speaking with other survivors of critical injury, that it comes down to the word value. The value of that individual to that agency or organization, and the value that individual is getting from their continued career. And you're finding that when you're talking to these folks that it's not always the most positive thing in the world, that these agencies are either through their policies or through a lack of training or commitment on the part of the highest levels is such that the individual's value changes and they're not so important to the agency anymore.
So you began to feel, after you returned to work after that massive effort, that that your value to the agency had changed. How did that manifest itself?
Well, it's hard to sit here and talk about something that you love so much. Talk about the agency that did so much for you, and you know, certainly if I could be as clear as possible, you know, my agency, I hit the lottery when I became a trooper with my department. I hit the lottery, and it took care of me for my entire adult life and will continue to take care of me for the rest of my life. However, it's not the department that necessarily failed me. It was human beings within the department that failed me. And some of the ways that manifested itself, the policies that were in place kind of put me in a box. The policies that existed at the time prevented me from being able to transfer from one job to another if I felt the desire to do so. The policies that were in place kept me from continuing to advance within my career. They kept me from being able to do some of the things that I had done in the past with respect to either my job assignment or some of the opportunities that were available to me. And there were some times where assignments that I had were taken away from me because, well, for no reason and no explanation, just all of a sudden changed to someone else doing that job and my services were no longer needed. So some of the things in my own background were subtle. Some of them were, communicated to me directly, but in the long run, there was a distinct difference in the way that I could continue to do my job because of the injuries that I had.
You retired at 25 years. Was that choice to retire? Was that based on, okay, listen, I've put my time in, it's time to go, or because you felt that you really weren't appreciated that much anymore?
Well, I had no, and I had no intentions of retiring when I hit my 25 years. When the accident happened, I was 47 years old. I was only a couple of years from my normal retirement, date. But I had no intentions of retiring. My career was going very well. My career seemed to be on a very much of an upward swing. And I just wanted to continue to do the job that I had come to love doing. I had no intentions of going when I would have been eligible to go. However, because of some of the circumstances, because of some of the things that I was starting to encounter, I felt it was going to be difficult. One additional thing was that the rules that were in place at the time almost put a stopwatch on my recovery. In other words, the length of time that I was going to be in a limited capacity has its limits. And there was discussion, behind closed doors as to whether or not I was going to be able to continue to do this job or be placed in a more permanent limited status, which would then have, kicked in a few other restrictions on what I was going to be able to do. So at the end of the day, I felt like it was not mandatory, but it was going to be in my best interest that I retire. I didn't retire because I had to. I retired because I wanted to.
I understand that. So when did you write the book?
I wrote the book. The plan for the book started just a few months before my retirement. I'd already declared to the department that I was going to retire, and I wanted to go out on my own terms. During that time, I was approached by a good friend of mine who was the department psychologist, Dr. Michael Askin, who is an author in his own right, who approached me and suggested that I write the book you know, as a way to continue to recover, to get the word out there and to express my thoughts and emotions in writing form so that other people can find their own message within the writing of the book. I started writing the book practically a week after I retired. It took me about 4 months to write it, maybe two more months to rewrite it. Never write angry, and then I published it. I published it shortly thereafter in the fall of 2017.
And the book is called Scars and Stripes. It's available where?
Well, it's actually, I'm not one of these techie folks that's able to get this thing on Amazon and everything else. I do have a website, forgedinscars.com, that I offer the book for sale. It's actually also available on the law enforcement supply company, the Officer Store. It's available on their website. So those are pretty much the only two places you can get the book. Go to forgedinscars.com. You can order it from right from there.
Well, we'll have to see if we can't help you get that book onto Amazon. Have a much wider audience. Now, I want to talk about the emotional aspect to these injuries. You're as a law enforcement professional, you are completely aware of post-traumatic stress. How did post-traumatic stress, if it did, play a role in the future for you?
Well, it's kind of interesting that you say that because, you know, obviously I know that there are so many of other individuals that suffer from PTSD. I actually have amnesia of my accident. Amnesia is very real. I have no memory of what took place from about 5 minutes before the accident occurred to about 24 hours later when I woke up in the hospital. Anything that I've been able to share in my lectures as I travel around or in book form or anything else, I've actually had to learn reconstructing through reading the official crash report or from statements of witnesses and the first responders that came to my aid. I have no memory. And ultimately, I believe that is what has actually helped me, even though I'm not a psychologist, a psychiatrist. I did not diagnose myself. I actually believe that my lack of memory of the accident has aided in not developing the symptoms of PTSD. Did I have struggles? Absolutely. Did I struggle, and I continue to struggle almost 4 years later with the fallout from the incident. But I don't appear to suffer in the same fashion as a lot of people do when we talk about the symptoms of PTSD.
Do you think that maybe some of that is because of the support that you received and the fact that you were able to work your way back to your position?
Yeah, sure. Absolutely, I do. I think that the feelings that I had immediately, the awareness, the light bulb moment, as I like to call it, of all of these, all of these people coming and sharing their support of my incident, being by my side, being with me throughout the entire ordeal, never made me feel like I was alone. Never made me feel like I was alone. Made me feel that I was loved and that I was going to be okay, even though certainly my injuries were telling me I was not going to be okay, that everybody else helping me, made it a much easier transition into this new life that I have. I don't like the words new normal because my whole life of structure and discipline tells me one thing. Normal is normal. There is no such thing as new normal because that changes normal.
Right.
Normal is what
exactly
it is.
What you're saying. But I think that for the listening audience, I think the critical lesson here is that post-traumatic stress disorder does not need to follow a catastrophic injury. It is through friendship and love and support of the organization and the people in the organization that can hold that down. And this is the critical topic, I believe. Now you speak about this all over the country, do you not?
Yes, I've actually been traveling to tell my story, share my story with a variety of different groups, because I believe that the lessons that were learned, the message itself of perseverance, of overcoming adversity, and finding new ways to serve, crosses a wide spectrum of different audiences. It isn't just, rooms full of cops. It's rooms full of other people in emergency services. It's church groups. It's kids. It's everybody that can get something from the message that when you fall down, the only thing that you can do is just get back up. I've been able to do that. It's a personal victory for me to be able to travel by myself to meet the demands of the schedule to do this, and ultimately to help other people to understand what those with a disability or fighting an injury have to go through every day.
While you're on this circuit, you come in contact with police officers, law enforcement officers who have been injured in the line of duty. What is your takeaway from all of these interactions as when it comes down to the way that they have been treated and how that has affected them?
Well, and again, I mentioned it earlier. Heartbreaking is the easiest word to use, and it makes me want to do more to help change the way that these people feel. To try to do everything in my part to raise awareness to the issues. All too often, the public gets to see how law enforcement responds to when one of their own, unfortunately, is killed in the line of duty. But in this particular case, all too often the public doesn't hear the stories of officers who are injured and continuing to fight and try to come back from those injuries, and all of the problems that they encounter, all the obstacles that they have to overcome. So, this has reemphasized my new direction in life to try to raise awareness to those issues, because if I don't lend my voice to the cause, who is going to speak for them?
And when you're talking about these critical injuries taking place, these injuries are taking place on a far more frequent basis than anybody realizes. Besides the fact that 57,000 police officers on the average a year are physically assaulted, the car accidents, the training accidents, there's so many other ways to become seriously injured in the line of duty. And this is happening all over the country. And it is imperative that we as a profession recognize that when a police officer is hurt or a law enforcement officer is hurt, they need support. They need to be acknowledged, and that is a critical part of the healing process. And yet, for some reason, Bob, I keep on hearing the opposite from so many people, which is why we've created our organization, The Wounded Blue. It is because of the way we are treating ourselves, and that to me is the most heartbreaking part.
I don't disagree with you, Randy, and I'll tell you that my whole life has been about structure and discipline and leadership. From a teenager, it was drummed into my head, being parts of these organizations, it was drummed into my head to to look after each other, to watch each other's backs. That term, I got your back, brother, it means something more to members of the emergency services, members of the armed forces. It means something more than just to the private citizen. And the one thing that I have learned over my lifetime is I understand leadership and what leadership is, what is required of leadership. And part of being a leader is absolutely looking after the welfare of your young men and women that you are asking to do the near impossible. You're asking them to lay it all on the line. And what we're finding out is that it's not so much an effective leader that fails us. It is a manager, a politician, someone who lacks the understanding of what it means to be a leader. And we have to change that. It has to start with training and providing information to those people who will oversee an injured member and to make sure that they know that that person has a family. That person is, you know, a human being that all they want is to continue to live, to work, to love, and to basically just be the person that they are. And if we don't train our leadership to recognize that, to look at review policies that could create problems, the time to look at a policy or the time to recognize the holes in a policy is not after the incident has occurred, it's before. Exactly. And we have to take a look at how those policies were written, who they were intended to be written for, and who they may unintentionally exclude if the policy is enacted. If we don't train our leaders on these things, then the only thing that those leaders can fall back on in some cases is maybe their experience. The rotational nature of leadership is such that a leader can move from job to job to job to job, ascend several levels in rank, and never have the situation of dealing with an injured member.
Exactly. And Bob, we're running out of time here, and I want to make sure that people can find you to book you for speaking engagements and also for your book. What is your website again?
Okay. It is www.forged.com. F-O-R-G-E-D, inscars.com, forgedinscars.com.
Forgedinscars.com. I urge my my listeners to go to that website, learn more about Bob. And Bob, I can't thank you enough for taking the time to share your story here on Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement.
Absolutely. My pleasure, Randy.
If you are one of my active duty law enforcement officer listeners, and you are like most of law enforcement, and you work extra jobs, you work the security job, the traffic jobs, most of the time you go through your own agency to do it. But there is another option as well, which can also lead to additional work assignments. Go to offdutypoliceofficers.com. These are my friends at law enforcement specialists, and they are based out of Arizona, but they are in most of the states in the United States, and they assist you in getting those extra work assignments. And the security jobs, the traffic jobs, and they work with your agency so that you're protected as well. So, and also, if you're one of my listeners who actually needs off-duty police officers to work security or to work extra jobs in traffic or whatever, you can contact them as well. So go to offdutypoliceofficers.com. That's offdutypoliceofficers.com, and see about getting some extra work assignments. And they are great people. I know them very well, and they are some good folks. Or you can call them 1-888-572-2442. That's offdutypoliceofficers.com.
End of Watch with Randy Sutton.
Each week on Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement, we pay our respects to those men and women of the profession who have given their lives in the line of duty. I am happy to say that this week, I don't have any names to read. It's really unusual, and I am so grateful that this week no law enforcement officers lost their lives in the line of duty. A number of them were shot, but nobody has died. So let's reflect on that and be thankful that at this Christmas season, let's hope that we go through the rest of the year with no other officers losing their lives as well. Thank you so much for tuning in this week to Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement, with me, your host, Randy Sutton. Couple things before we say goodbye. First of all, check out my books on Amazon.com. My latest one, The Power of Legacy, Personal Heroes of America's Most Inspiring People, came out a few months ago, and you can find it there along with all my other books. Also, Facebook. Check me out on Facebook, The Voice of American Law Enforcement. That's where you will find me. And if you're a Twitterer, LT, at LT Randy Sutton. So once again, thank you guys for tuning in to Blue Lives Radio, The Voice of American Law Enforcement.